Earplay is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. A series of contemporary plays for radio. Earplay.
Earplay presents the BBC production of Monk by John Kirkmorris. Kirkmorris lives in Sussex, England. His first radio play was produced by the BBC in 1970, and since then he has written for both BBC radio and television. His radio play, Death of a Pig, was presented by Earplay last season. Monk by John Kirkmorris.
Flattered, Jim. Look, Jim, look, I've got to go. No messages. Okay? I'll expect a letter. Yeah. And you, Jimmy.
Still closed. I want you to think about the coin in your hand. Bear down on it with your tiny mind, okay? Okay. Your arm is beginning to rise. It is, isn't it? You can't stop it. All the way, baby.
Will this help with the...
No, it only works for arms. Oh, I... How do you know without trying?
I have tried once.
I do relate to you, Brian. We're very relative. It's great.
Yeah, but you know...
No, not dangerous. Just nice. Is that thing on?
1, 9, 10. Testing. The cat set on the rat. How about that? we haven't had a proper spring. The lawn's under 2 feet of water. Slopping over the top of the swimming pool. The outlet valve's choked with dead leaves. I've asked Alf Dandridge to sort it out, but he says deep sea diving isn't in my contract. Tomorrow I'll go out there with a bamboo pole. Never go at it myself. Barney's gone with a girl to visit her auntie in Dorking, so I'm all on my Todd.
Boo hoo.
He loves the wet. He can splash in his new red wellies and wear that woolly hat his grandma made for him. And they've gone on the bus. Daphne's all right with a boy, but she's not the world's brightest. When she was changed to Mr. That little sod bit her. She had teeth marks all the way up her arm. She came crying to me. What should I do, Mr. Sims? She said. Bite him back, I said. I told her she had my permission to whack him, which wasn't what she wanted at all. Yeah, that's my job, but I have no heart to do it. Oh. I've got a cold coming. I hope it's a flu. Makes you dopey and light-headed so you don't give her monkeys. Oh, I could do the rest. If the rain let up for a while, I'd go for a run. Not a long one, just up to the old camp and back. Pounding away on those concrete piles until I'd had enough. I could even climb that cedar tree. But it's not going to let up. It's going to rain for another 40 days and nights and we're all going to be drowned in our beds. So... Just going to sit here and talk into this thing? Well, what else can I do? Oh, yeah, I can worry about my income tax. Oh, I've got cold shivers just saying the name. They can't touch me. Just don't rush me all at once. Dr. Freshman warned me that anxiety is bad for my complexion, and so is poverty. I haven't worked for 5 months, and that's only the beginning. Ah, no, I'm ducking again. I do have money, and it's tied up in land and stuff, and not all of it in this country. This very minute I've got consultants working on a transfer to Ireland. I don't know exactly how much I'm worth, not to the last pound, no, anyway. Let's just say I'll have no immediate financial worries for the next 10 years. But for a borough boy, I've done real well. I'm the only one in our street who owns his own saloon bar, and a genuine imported pagoda. When I leave here, I won't miss any of it. Check that big cedar tree. Perhaps I can find a way of taking it with me. Freshman's bored to the eyeballs with my little peculiarities. He has trouble staying awake. He makes a little steeple with his hands in front of his face when he feels a yawn coming. When he lets a big one go, you can see his waistcoat shaking. He's a nose picker too, sly devil. He teases them out a millimetre at a time. His life's been much more interesting than mine. At one time, for a laugh, I told him I had a dream where he was psychoanalysing horses and the Viennese cavalry. But they took it very well. So droll, Brown. So penetrating. So foolish. Everyone knows it's the officers who are maladjusted. He's always got his antenna ready for a bit of deviancy. So I make up the occasional dream with lashings of kyber. Mind you, it wasn't all waste. He's taught me that you don't forget. And whatever's hurting you is buried deep in the past. You can't shake it off any more than you can change the colour of your eyes. Unseen cargo of distress is his phrase for it. Another thing I learned was that you're just dealt a few cards in life and you don't get a second hand. And what did he say? We must reconcile ourselves to ourselves. The affection we feel for another is the surplus of love we have for the self. Yeah. And if you detest yourself, fair doctor, take 6 of the enclosed 3 times a day. Yeah, I'm a trap rat on a chewing my tail. Oh, a question for Mr. Freshman. If we change our body size every 7 years, why isn't the memory wiped out at the same time? Answer, your next question, please. But I haven't been honest with Freshman, not totally. I didn't mind telling him that I beat my meat and I hoard money and hate myself for distraction. I even told him things about my married life I once thought was sacred, but I couldn't give him the whole picture. I mean, there's a limit in everything. I wouldn't tell him about the mean strokes I've pulled on friends, for instance. All that digging into my childhood left me raw. I was faking, too, and putting on a show to let him believe I was in control of my life. You know, I'm so much in control, I only need 8 Librium a day. I'm bloody hypo, too. I have aches and tiny cramps, and when I'm in bed at night, I sweat like a racehorse. I shower 3 times a day in case Barney should smell me. I wish that... I'm going to tell it just once more. I speak of this thing because it doesn't yawn or pick its nose or condemn me. When I finish, I put the tape in the box and forget about it. In 10 years' time, I'll play it again and give myself a good laugh. My heroes are black and dead. I worship their work. Whitey swings and the music isn't a natural experience. But give a 5-year-old black kid a beat to dance to and he'll fall into a trance. It's in the blood. Play the black man's music, Whitey has to unlearn and start all over again. Yeah, I've never got on well with blacks, personally. Big confession, I haven't. I feel threatened. They're elemental, yeah. They belong in the world, whereas I'm weedy and not very tall and frightened of the dark. So it's a threat, isn't it? My first 12-string was a Gibson. The man I bought it from, a sailor I met down the Broadway, he brought it in from Cuba where somebody had worked it over with silver inlay and punchy plating around the box. I called it El Humidor because it looked like the thing you carry cigars in. It was a bitch to play. 6 months, I couldn't get anything out of it. The problem was maintaining decent rhythm when my brain was racing ahead of my hands. Oh, I nearly gave up on it. My wrists weren't too strong either, so I carried a tennis ball in my pocket and squeezed it to strengthen my hands. After a couple of hours' practice, I had to fill the wash basin with hot water and soak the stiffness out of my tendons. I still got that box somewhere. I wasn't a natural. I'd picked at the piano and blown a bugle with a little band we had at the primary school, stuck in the third row with the rest of the untalented. But what I had, and the others lacked, was a determination to do something. Well, anything, but it had to be in music. I'm glad I came up from the basement. The lessons they learned. I could have stayed with four chords and used a capo to give myself a big repertoire today. I'd still be a pub performer. I stuck with the acoustic because I knew there was no shortcut to good technique. I persisted with sight reading for the same reason. Oh, in the beginning, I wept with frustration. There was nobody around to teach me. Nick was astonished when I showed him I could sight read. He thought I was the original busker. I was really made up then. Definitely one of the chaps. The Fedders, Dalston, 1964, early summer, eh? On Friday nights, they ran an all-comers with a New Orleans-style band to hold it all together. I sat in with them once or twice just for laughs. Then they soloed me for 30 bob a night. I spent a quid out of the 1.5 on a taxi, and welcome to it. I would have done it for nothing. At that time, of course, the whole country was reeling from Mersey fever, all except the Fedders, where the herd wanted something to shout over. They wasn't interested in the music, you know. It was dead rough, but, not knowing any better, I thought it was the artistic capital. I loved it. Even the smells, beer and cigarettes and women's sweaty perfume. The main vocalist, he was a kid of my age, a Herbert with a blonde quiff and pimples. He kept a hairdresser's comb in the back pocket of his jeans to do running repairs on his coiffure. Oh, he thought he was terrific, screaming out Buddy Holly numbers and holding the mic as he was about to mount it. He sang, if that's the word, and it isn't, in front of a trio calling themselves the Top Notes. They excited me just because they were so bad. I thought, if they can make a living out of this, surely they're going out and go two or three better. Nice house, the Fedders. A few years ago, the publican was knifed to death in the cellar. Roberts. Wally Roberts. Well, the rest of the week, where was I? Oh, yeah, the Fedders. Yeah, somebody shivved the landlord in his own cellar. I don't think they found the man who did it. And in a week, I was humping hides for Lieberman Brothers in Woolwich. The wages were pathetic, a tenner a week top work with a couple more for Saturday mornings. And the governors didn't work Saturdays, of course, it was their Sabbath. 6 days a week, I had to scrub down with brown soap before going home. Oh, that must be one of the worst jobs in the world. I smell those rotten hides now. The cream were the South American. They still had lumps of putrid meat sticking to them. And they had ticks in them. Evil jumping bastards that come out in the hot weather. If they got into your clothes, oh, you were for it. Don't know why I stuck it so long. My 3 years with the firm was almost a record. And when I went to old man Lieberman in 1965 to tell him I was jacking, tears stood out in his eyes. How can you do this to us, Brian? This ain't a job, it's a career. In 2 more years, you'd be making enough to get married. He offered me the charge hands job that he could have thrown in his granddaughter on a plate for the good it would have done him. I was semi-pro by then, and I could get far more on the road than I would by piling cowskins. They had two little old men in the tanning shed stoking up the mixture with huge wooden paddles. The dwarves, Snow White never mentioned, Stinky and Pongy. That's what they use in tanning, dog muck. Yeah, that'd be something to tell your grandchildren. What do you do for a living, Granddad? I'm a turd stirrer lad in a tannery. My mother was born Margaret Alexandra Hole. You couldn't hope to get closer than that. She was a respectable Tom, which meant she'd only do it for money, and her visitors had to remove their boots first. And Ronnie Sims met her when he came out of the army in 1945, and he was still fighting. I was on the way before they legalised their love, and that didn't improve his temper. He swore I wasn't his child. I'm inclined to believe him. He uncertainly preyed on his mind, and, as it wasn't a very big mind to begin with, he'd take it out on the smallest and nearest. Me. He beat me with his hands and his belt. Oh, I still got a scar on my bonce with a buckle, but a strap caught me. He had a loud voice. That disgusted him. I was 4 or 5 years old, and he beat me like I was a man. Well, in 1953, Ron Sims was driving an articulator for BRS, and one night he kept on going. I was so happy, I learned to smile. Eventually, he joined up with a woman in Lincolnshire and had another family by her. Margaret wouldn't divorce him for years. She wasn't going to lose her maintenance, was she? She kept me and my sister, Phil, with her for the same reason. In a way, Phil suffered more than I did. She left home to go nursing at 16 and dropped right outside. I don't know where she lives or even if she's married or what. She's written once in 11 years to give the old lady a mouthful. Yeah, Phil left home in the spring of 66 and I left a few weeks later. I had 2 rooms over a pressing shop in Arundel Street. Well, as I was carrying my cases to the taxi, Mum, she came out and ear-holed me. She stuck out her hand. "What's that for?" I said. "My rent," she said, all flushed and nasty. 1 week's notice. So I counted it out for her in ones and silver into that little palm. And I stuck out my own hand. "Receipt, please." About 3 years ago, when I gave her the keys to her bungalow, she referred to the incident, but I pretended not to hear. And today, Mumsy literally creaks with pride. "Oh, it's all my Brian, and he gets it from my side of the family." In fact, at the time, it was, "Why don't you give up that bloody banjo and get yourself a decent job?" My life is arranged not to cross hers. I visit twice a year, but I don't allow her in my house. She's never seen Barney, for instance, and she won't. I'm not vengeful. I just simply don't want to be reminded. Yeah, she had her reasons. She had no money when my father dumped her, and her 2 kids to raise without support, etc., etc. I mean, I know her version backwards and sideways. And it's true for all I know, and the other abandoned wives don't go on the batter and drag the kids up on the leavings. Phil and I were always the worst-dressed pair in the building, but her wardrobe was always full of gear she wore once and got tired of. It wasn't enough money for a good fee, but she couldn't wear cheap perfume and cut down her 40 fags a day, could she? Oh, no. The cause of her trouble was her pretty face, I suppose. Good-looking women without character expect their little privileges and some mug to pay the bills. She's living with a fella now called Eric. They want to marry when he gets a divorce. He's about 10 years younger than she is. You know, you've got to give it to the old cow. She can still pull him. Freshman said, "We spend the first 30 years of life discovering who we are." "Oh, yes," said doctor. "And we spend the next 30 trying to forget it." I do try too. Yet every time I make a small step forward, I remember where I come from and what made me. And then... "Oh, I'm busy, can't it wait?" I've thought a lot about Nick recently. Where he is, what he's doing, if he's still bitter. Got every right to be. When he showed me he took me seriously as a musician, I felt I'd been packed on there by Django. I had tremendous respect for him. Not just because he had a Guildhall training and all that, but he had taste, judgment, what's the word? Clarity. No, spareness, economy, I don't know. Elegance, I mean. When the punters hear Timbo's Garden and Skyrimer, they're hearing Nick. He did all the arrangements and edited the masters. I mean, his rhythmic control was phenomenal. Hundreds of times... when I was soloing, I got lost. And he always picked it up, always. And what's more, he knew what I was intending better than I did. Really, he has it all. Intuition, brain, style. You could ask him to write a cantata on a bus ride from Oxford Street to Charing Cross, and he'd have written it by the time he reached Piccadilly Circus. And all the parts in longhand. Now, Nick's, he's wasted inside a company. Test records for... stereo buffs. Everybody knows they don't give a fart for what comes out of the baffle as long as it's cold and clear as an icicle. But outside rock music, Nick and I didn't go for the same things. And when the acid heads took up Sarty in a big way, I went right along. Nick looked down his nose. Percy Grainger and the Berry, he called it. The list of debtors grows the more I look at it. Nick, Alan, Ockie, even
Harold's got a place in here somewhere. He was stuffing it away in that old Osso tin he used as a safe. But give him his due, he was piling it away for us too. I had 5 post office savings books in different names. And he didn't interfere in the programme. No, we did the plane, and he worried about the percentages. When he got the push, he was quite philosophical. I think small, he said. Too small for you, clever lot. Thanks for the run, lads. I enjoyed it. Typically, the papers got it wrong about the final bus sat with Harold. From the way they slanted it, you think Harold was the victim of a plot to deprive him of his rights. The truth was, like he said at the time, we outgrew him, and he couldn't take all the travelling. His wife was a little thing with a nutcracker face. As long as you didn't trust him out of her sight. Sweet Oil was first and last a rose show. He needs an excuse. But the press, they've never liked me. And it's mutual. Pressman says I'd be more paranoid if they wrote nothing. See, I can't play along with that kind of curiosity. What do I have for breakfast and with who? I freeze inside. I wonder, so what you got to do with you? Only that's for both, and so I stay stum. Actually, I don't mind the needless so much. It's the reverential boys. No, we really didn't need a road manager after Harold, so Nick and I just managed the job between us. I can talk money to anybody, and Nick wrote the letter when we needed one, and we kipped like sardines in the back of the Bedford. If we wanted to change the climate, we used the booking agent in town to fix up a short tour of Denmark or whatever. In 3 years, we've got ourselves a routine. Winter, session work, if we could get it. Springtime, the club circuit. Summer, touring the resorts here in England. And autumn, we were good Europeans. It was about that time that I got an Oxo tin of my own and started to buy house property for later development. So, Harold was a clown, but nice with it. Nobody ever described Ray Angel that way. If he lost an arm, I wouldn't help him look for it. He's pure evil, coming and going. Oh. Even his smile is stuck under his chops with sellotape, and he uses Yiddish all the time. He's hoping he'll be made an honorary Jew. Though he's no more Jewish than our cat. And nobody dresses better. His suits are made by 2 brothers in New York. He's never tired of telling you how he jets the cloth across the Atlantic to be made up by this pair of geniuses. His shirts are best lawn from Paris. Silk next to his belt. Platinum links, tooled in Milan. His shoes are made from unborn calf. Degenerate toad. Yeah, when Ray Angel's togged up, he's ready for the top of the Christmas tree. When I go and see him, which is as little as possible, I'll make a point of going scruffy. But what a pain on his face is sweet to see. He lives in a detached house in Hampstead that was built by a Maharaja for his English girlfriend. It's a strange thing. With all his power and so forth, he's a bunch of twitchy nerves. It was him who started this monk business. It began as a joke. About 5 years ago, my body was falling out of Air Force. I was run down with touring and a rotten grub and so forth, and somewhere I read you could preserve your hair by not washing it, so that's what I'd done. I didn't touch it for 3 or 4 months, and right enough, the thin bit started to grow back. It was made up. I stank, but I had a thatch again. And then the nit struck. It was touring the American bases in Germany, and I caught impetigo, which I thought was something only kids got. And a US Army medic shaved my swede and painted it blue. I could have stuck a badge over my eyes and joined the police force. It took ages for my hair to reappear again. When it did, I liked it short, no more poncing about with dryers and lotion. And, it felt clean. But what with the weight I lost around that time and this fuzzy skull, I looked like a candidate for a seminary. After Germany, Angel had fixed up our first festival. That was at the Crystal Palace. The chaps had been giving me some stick about the hair. Ockie said I looked like an advert for a liqueur. Anyway, Angel fixed on this, and in the publicity handouts, he billed me as B. Monk Sims. Just like that. Oh, that gig was a cracker. Great crowd, lovely weather, no aggro. Nick was brimming with witties. We just picked up terrific sales and estates with Skyline. I was a total one-off. That weekend, it all came together. Festivals, records, my famished looks. We finished in the early hours of Monday morning. By the time the milk was being delivered, we pushed every other group out of the running. The offers were coming into Angel's office so fast, the phones didn't have time to call. Ockie ran round pinching himself, saying, "Stay out of my dream, this one's booked." Well, I got most of the attention, because I was up front most of the time. And we had no regular vocalist, and the press had to latch on to somebody. They made hay with my mannerisms. The way I mumble when I'm playing, and the no-on-course bit, turning my back on the audience. I cured myself of that, but I had a hell of a job keeping concentration, looking down several thousand throats. The snotty papers competed among themselves to see who could get most mileage out of the new nickname. A monk of great renown, haunted acolyte of funk. Oh, and the best and the worst, sizzling friar. Angel wet himself with excitement. He designed a t-shirt with a crucifix on the chest and a guitar on the belly. Well, you have to give it to the dopey bastard. It is cheap, he owes nothing back. Hockey wasn't the best drummer in the world. He didn't need to be. Everything had to be shown to him with lots of hand movements. And he said, quite truthfully, he was only in the game for his cleft. And he wasn't disappointed. And he likes him, too. I never heard of one going bad on him. He had a lot of techniques, from I'm Ockie, Who Are You, right up to Flowers and a Hire Car. Refusals didn't bother him either. We'd be passing a shop, and he'd clock a pretty assistant, and he'd walk inside like a blind man. And he'd put out his hand, sometimes on the girl's arse, and say, "Is this where they test the eyes?" Yeah, one I remember, he wasn't too strong with delicacy. In Yarmouth once, I popped out of my dressing room to clue him up on a number. I opened the door, and there he was, charvering this big black dancer up against the radiator. She still had on her feathers and sequins, but her tights were around one ankle. I stood there for about 2 seconds with my mouth open. A right twist. But Ockie just turned and said over his shoulder, "Hang about, Brian, I'll be through here in a minute. Any time, anywhere, have it while it's hot." Yeah. Who would I most like to be if I wasn't me? Yes. Ockie's got the secret. He doesn't give a monkeys, but he hasn't got an enemy in the world. He's got a very understanding wife. And Sims and the women, well. Yeah, come in. Oh, can you stick it in the oven? Oh, what did Al say about those spuds? Oh, maybe the fairies had them. They'll be frying tonight in Fairyland. Where have I got to? The other day, I took a piece of paper and worked out how much love I'd had in my life. Reckoning on the amount of time I was married and going queso and so on. Totting up, I worked out I've been alone for 11 years out of the last 15. Boo-hoo. Yeah. For a borough boy, I was late starting. I was 16 before I had my first nibble. I didn't expect to be happy. I know the reason now. In those days, I suppose, I didn't have the knack of pulling them and left it there. To me, sex is mostly a head thing anyway. I have to be in love just to perform at all. Oh, the weirdest bird I knew was Hillary. She said she was an artist model, though I never knew her work at it. She stayed with me in Arundel Street for about 6 months on and off. Skinny girl with lopsided bristles and a smokeless cough. She turned up for a few days and disappeared again. When she got back, she never explained where she'd been or what she'd been doing, and like an idiot, I gave her the key once when I was on tour. I came back late one night and found these two Chinese waiters dossing there, cooking noodles in a huge copper bowl. And the end came very sudden. I woke up one morning, saw her putting on her clothes. She didn't usually roll out until noon, so I asked her what was up. "It's you," she said. "I've had them hungry and I've had them horny, and some hung on to their mothers, but I can't take sad bastards. You were crying in your sleep again." She was so angry. Really in a temper. Where was I to know? She was very supple. Like a set of rubber bands. Once, I brought some people round and found her doing handstands in the fireplace. Very embarrassing. She was in her shift. And she didn't wear panties. Not really. I've always wanted to sing, ever since I was tiny. Anything to do, ballads, John Brown's body, hymn tunes even. But I had no voice, only this sense of pitch. Nick said my vocal style was a mixture of Peggy Lee's and Hitler's. The shrinks will tell you that it's guitar as a sort of substitute, but for me, the box was a replacement for the voice I didn't have. Doxologies was meant to be a song without words. Oh, I loved typing it. In fact, that was the last project I really enjoyed. The sales figures didn't help my ego. Somebody wanted to call the album Compline, but Angel vetoed it. How can you call a record after a health food, he said. And a crit said I was being deliberately obscure. I bet, though, if I performed it in a cathedral with a bishop to give the blessing, they'd say it was the greatest thing since rat bread. Yeah, they've accused me of every crime except intelligence. What about the cavolt we had over Mother of Mercy? The scribe said it was built round cant language for mainline fixing, which tells you a lot about scribes and nothing about the song. No, it was based on a true story that Nick told me. No, this actually happened to his sister. She's about 16, just at the age when she wanted to do her bit for mankind, so she put all these goodies in a bag and trotted down to some bomb site to give the old methods a treat. And when she got there, all they wanted her to do was trot round the ironmongers to fill the bottles for them. Well, it's pretty slight, I agree, though it had some nice verses and it was funny and sad at the same time. No, dope was never like that. It's just stupid. I mean, Terry Farr fixed, didn't he? Nice smell he left behind him. His choice. When he got too glassy-eyed to hold the sticks, it killed him. Taken to that clinic in Godalming, just down the road from here. And they pumped him full of Largactil. For 20 hours and a 24, he was zonked out. Within a week of discharging himself, he was back on 6 ampules a day. Ficeptone, I think it was. All in all, he was no loss. It was a good drama, but he had no count. I'm going to talk about Jean. We first met when she was working as Connor's secretary. I had a piece of property in Kilburn that Connor wanted. At the death, we didn't do a deal. I was struck with her, though. Long afterwards, she kept popping into my head and in the strangest places, but... Well, I thought there wasn't my chance in 100 she'd have anything to do with me, an uncouth musician person who left school at 15. That's how I used to think, always boosting myself. Well, why should she? With those looks and a good brain, and clean with it. Connor himself was top-heavy with personality. Handsome bloke, built solid like an amateur wrestler. He was in his 50s, but he looked younger. So, you can imagine my surprise, as they say, when she turned up at the theatre in Gateshead and asked if I'd take her out to dinner. Well, that was shrewd. She knew I wouldn't have the nerve to make the move. Over dinner, she told me she wanted to see me, just like that. And so she asked the landlord at Arundel Street where I was working. Then she got on a train and came straight up. This was early spring, second week in March. So after the second half interval, we went into Newcastle to eat. I picked this rubbish steak out, something dreadful. I was so nervous I stopped coffee down my shirt front. We had a few brandies to wash the taste away, and then the carriage came back. It was a fair night, so we walked down to the river. We sat for at least an hour rabbiting away and staring at the dirty water. I forget what we talked about. But later, she said I sounded mad with ambition. And I was, because, well, this took place before the group took off in a big way, and long before the Angel fiasco. I was well into my stride when she leaned across and put her hand on my mouth. She wasn't smiling. Then she put her mouth where her hand had been. And when I got my breath back, she said she wanted to go to bed. And would I arrange it, please? That night, I had the best experience of my life. Before or since. And then when that weekend was over, she said there wasn't going to be another one. There was this man who wanted to marry her. He was getting a divorce on her account. The bottom dropped out so fast I was dizzy. Not my fault, naturally. I'd learned to go 5 minutes in my head I was taking out mortgages. The machine got so heavy, I didn't want to live. For 3 months, I was horrible to be. I was irritable, arrogant, bloody cruel at times, and not caring. I got busy booking out all the gigs I could, even church socials and places, hundreds of miles apart, so I wouldn't have time to think between the work and the travelling. I was going full pelt for a breakdown. And then one lunchtime, Nick got me into a pub on our own and filled me up with a mixture of gin and cider. What a buzz. And then Nick talked to me like a big brother. He said the group was whacked out with travelling and I was behaving like a crazy bastard. Nobody liked me. Which he couldn't understand, he said, because I was really quite a nice bloke. That set me right off. I cried into my glass. I told him about Jean, and she heard that already. He said I ought to write it out of my system. And right there and then, we worked out something on the back of the beer mat, a descending phrase and treble over a repeated bass figure. And Nick hummed it over the racket in the bar. And it was okay. Well, he went back to the van and wrote it up with an arpeggio part on the acoustic as an introduction. Hockey found a name as usual, Last Boat Home. I wrote a lyric for it, which we didn't use. We played it a lot that summer, and it got on the B-side of Lubricator. After Gene came back, I didn't play it again. And after that session, I had the biggest hangover of my life. I drank 2/3 of the bottle of gin in the city. Even the smell of it makes me puke nowadays. And then it got to be October. We'd gone north yet again. We were fixed up with a run of quickies round Doncaster. The last was a Lulu, a working man's club in a pit village. Dressing room was a caravan next to the outside toilet. We had two spots that night. The first of them was between a bald comedian and a ventriloquist with loose dentures. We jumped in with some pop crap and we were getting all these gargoyles nicely warmed up when I saw Jean sitting on her own, a table, with a ginger ale beside her. I don't know how I got through that spot. Before the last chord stopped resonating, I jumped off the station away through the emergency door. I was loading up suitcases into the bedroom when Nick came out and he said I ought to see her. I told him to mind his own and went unloaded. Then I felt a hand tug at my sleeve and Jean stood there with her eyes closed and tears running in the corners of her mouth. I led her into a corner where they stacked the empty barrels and put my arms around her. We had a reunion supper of skating sticks, and the boys made up a bridal chamber for us in the back of the van, and we sang and played all the way back to London. But I wouldn't touch her until we were married, and that took all of a week to arrange. Anyone who says you do your best work when you're suffering, then that man talks out of his trousers. The 3 years I had with Jean were the most productive in terms of music. Oil became a name group. When we toured, we went as part of decent package shows and not like the Raggle Taggle Gypsies. Barney will be 4 in August. Yeah, I'll have to get mobile to find him at school. He's mine, all right. He has to be with those droopy eyelids and his style of talking. But I give a toss what he does when he grows up. I just want him to be happy. I don't believe Jean cares nothing for him. She can't. Because I didn't believe she'd leave until it happened. Well, she didn't like the life. I appreciated that. Why should she? So I tried to protect her by keeping it at a distance. Moved out of London, bought this place, tried to make friends with her sort of people. God knows that cost me an effort because I couldn't bear to see or hear half of them. Well, Barney gave her a hard time when he was on the way and she lost half a dozen teeth and he was a difficult birth. She couldn't feed him properly because her milk wouldn't flow. I grew to be afraid of her displeasure. It was easy to retire into the work that she despised so much. And then I couldn't be a husband. And I could go on intermittently for months at a time. So, sure, she had provocation. And always at the back of us was Angel saying, achieve, achieve, achieve. The order before the last one, she up and said she wanted to go back to work for Connor, did I mind? Well, not a bit. She had a car of her own, a small flat in Victoria she used to stay in overnight. Christmas time, I bought a tree and tidied it up with lots of presents and asked loads of people to the house, they're friends of mine. At 4:30 on Christmas Eve, she phoned to tell me she wasn't coming back. I took the call on the upstairs landing. There was a lot of noise down below, so I had to shout.
Yeah.
Quite a matter of fact, she told me she was going to set up house with Connor. There was no point in trying to talk her out of it. What about your child, I said. Not Barney, but your child. I could almost see her shrug. She said he didn't need her, lying her head off. Oh, I was so confused, I asked her there and then what I should do about the presents. There was a silence. And she put the phone down gently and I was standing there with the receiver, clicking away my hand. It came to me a little later that Connor was the man who was going to divorce his wife to marry her. That made our marriage an interlude in her big romance. Charming. I've seen her only once since. All her stuff is here just as she left it, but she won't come back. My solicitor has papers ready to serve on her, only she gags about, and he hasn't been able to send them. Last autumn, I had to go to that reception with the American Embassy people. The host was some geezer with a lot of clout in the arts council, a big beaming fairy in denims. I was rabbiting away with a woman journalist when this couple walked in. Jean and her new dreamboat. Oh, they were very taken with each other. I know Jean well enough to realise she wasn't long out of bed, and very nice too, thank you. He was tall and sunburned, and he kept touching her as if he'd won her in a sweepstake. The party happened in the same week we returned from that cock-up in America. The American tour showed me just how far gone was my place in the big scene. 16 cities in 22 days. Angel confined to his bed in New York with salmonella, piss-poor crowds. The organisers in Monterey, running away with the money. As far as I'm concerned, they can give California back to the Apaches. And we came back to those 2 horrible months in the studio. I wanted to renew our old contracts, but Angel put the blocks on. Now, why shouldn't he promote the company if he's saying he'll keep the profits? It was a cast-iron excuse to interfere in the material. I was so demoralised, what with the American trip, you know, I just fell in. Well, I mean, I knew what I was doing. I don't know where Angel found there's no hopers. One of them was a nephew who once jockeyed a mobile disco show, or was there hairdressers? Edwin Whittaker. Ooh, he was a real sweetheart. He'd hide himself in the booth for 20 minutes at a time. Ideating, he called it. I think he was in there buffing up his nails. 30 musicians and engineers eating up the overheads while he lay down in the dark. Jimmy Ross was on hand to protect Angel's interests. And needling me to get a move on. Oh, I was whacked out, man. I was trying and failing is acceptable. When you start knowing you've got a bummer, nothing can make it good. And the European trip coming on top of everything probably put the lid on it. Frankly, I wanted to spend the Christmas with Barney. I argued and argued with Angel, and I just gave in and packed to get myself ready. I hated myself for doing it. In a phrase of startling brilliance and originality, Angel said, I'll never forget these emotive words, the show must go on. Yeah, where does he get them? We now come to my big tantrum. I got rested. I was feeling a lot better in myself. One crisis was over and I felt fit enough to take on the next one. In February, Angel's office got in touch. Would I have lunch with Ray on Friday the 20th? Yeah, sure, I said, why not? On the day, I decided against using the car. I went up by train instead. And I had a couple of scotches on the way up. Something which is very much against form. So by the time we reached Waterloo, I was already a bit high. At Kingsway, Angel threw everybody out of the office so we could be alone. He sat down. I sat down. Solemn moment. He talked to me like a grieved parent. He told me I didn't trust him. Wherever did he get that idea? That I was disloyal, secretive, opinionated. This went on for about a quarter of an hour. Then he put his finger on the spot. You've been concealing assets, haven't you, Brian? I asked him to explain. He said I had all kinds of properties he wasn't supposed to know about. His accountant and mine shared the same office building, and he got to hear, quite by accident, naturally, that I was a substantial landlord with undeclared income. Well, I shrugged that off too. I told him he had management of my services and the monies arising from them. What I did with my private assets was my own business. He leaned back and shook his head. "I'm surprised at you, Brian," he said. "Our paper says all services. I can even use your bath water if I wanted to." I invited him to try. "I could swallow you up," he said. "I could sue you and lose the case, but I'd make sure it would drag on long enough to skint you, couldn't I?" But that wasn't the real issue. He wanted to know when I was prepared to come back to work and under what conditions. But at last my turn came round. I told him our end of the music business was shaking itself up, and for the time being, white-hot guitarists were bad news, unless you were an innovator, and I haven't been that since Sweet Oil. Current taste was for vocalists. I was jazz-orientated, too, and I wasn't going to turn myself into a cowboy doing the Italian salute with his instrument to an auditorium full of screaming weenies. I was tired out after 12 years of constant work. I'd earned a holiday and I intended to take one. If I went on at the present rate, I'd be finished for good within 6 months. And he was trying to milk a dead cow. The angel stared at me for a few minutes, saying nothing. Then he looked at his watch, and he says, "Come on," he said, "let's fill our heads." "Have you been listening?" I said. "Sure," he said, "every word. And I think you've got something too. But let's eat on it." And we went to that private dining club that was behind the Haymarket. The one with the walls panelled in silk where the lights are so dim they give you a white stick to find a way around the menu. Ray was expected and the waitress kept bowing to him as if he was an ambassador at a garden party. I wasn't hungry. I asked for a piece of halibut and a bottle of white wine. Nothing to start with. I settled back to watch Angel eat. Now that is quite a performance in its own right. Angel talked while he ate too. I don't remember much of what he said, though one remark stood out. "The public doesn't know what it wants until you show them," he said. "What it doesn't want is art. They prefer crap. They're used to the taste of it." And he was still rubbishing the punters when the coffee came. The waiter left the tray on the table and did his salami business. The interruption set Angel's mind working in another direction. "What are you going to do about that wife of yours, Brian? You're going to have to dump her. You know that, don't you?" I was too shocked to speak. He poured the coffee in a thimble-sized cup, talking away as casually as he was discussing the stock market. "I like Jean," he said, "I really do. She's got presence." Presence was very big with him just then. "She's not for you." "Never was. I mean, she's not doing the old image much good when she's screwing you around half London, is it?" Rage boiled up in my stomach. It was like a scream I had to let out the diaphragm. He was still looking at me, waiting for an answer. So I gave him one, right in the mouth, in my elbow. If his teeth hadn't been in the way, it would have gone right through his head. Then I tilted the table and dumped everything in his lap. Glasses, coffee, things, the lot. He yelped when the hot coffee touched his skin. I was shouting too, looking at that scream. I really wanted to kill him, and he knew it. I hacked at him, but he covered his crotch with his hands, and he tried to get away by scuttling around the end of the upturned table, whimpering and showing the whites of his eyes. All the rest of them had gone dead quiet, of course. Two of the waiters picked me up, and I was still shouting, and they carried me into a room where they stored dry goods. Then a guy with a tall white hat stood at the door with a meat cleaver to stop me moving. Very heavy scene. After a while, they brought in Angel. They wiped him down with napkins. I noticed he didn't even try to speak. His mouth was full of broken crumbs. Well, about 3 o'clock they let me go. No charges, but they owed me a bill for the damages, which I tore up when I got home. Guests don't pay for lunch. I didn't feel anything much, quite elated one moment. Then I was full of anger for what I'd done the next. But no remorse. All that for God's sake. Well, that night, I was giving Barney his bath and I got this sudden reaction. I began to cry and I couldn't stop. There were huge drops dropping from my cheeks into Barney's bathwater. He joined in, didn't he? The girl, Daphne, she came in to see what the fuss was. And lo and behold, she starts too. I got my doctor to come round and give me a shot. I was sparked out for 18 hours. End of story. Angel isn't going to let me go. Not after what I did to him. But now I'm at the side of the ground. So I have to get mobile. You might put the bubble into the revenue and check my assets. I know where some of his bodies are buried, too. Like Ross procuring a female person for him, who hadn't reached the age of reason, let alone consent. Mine's a success story, in a way. I worked hard, saved my bread, and married the princess. Westman says I'm a mature and integrated mess. He told me once a prayer his mother taught him. Dear God, don't let me suffer all I can endure. I can't be utterly worthless, or I'd have broken. But the next stage has something to do with not fighting. I'll have to work out the meaning when I've passed through it. One thing is going to bother me, just how good was I, and for how long? The group, the first oil, I mean. They were like a gang of kids chasing a ball up an alley, but it was a real ball and it was purest gold. I'm fresh out of new ideas, so I'd have been a museum. Get how many, even the greatest, hold on to that freshness after they're 35? I'm only 4 years away from that line. Some are mad, more are dead. And the worst of all, I have to keep on trying when the dynamo's broken. So thank God I don't have to try. And yet I'll miss some of it, some parts of this. Not at the moment when you've got them and they're settling in for a treat. That big, forgiving animal waiting in the dark. And the lights go down, and from the first few chords, you just know you'll never, never die.
By John Kirk Morris. Nigel Anthony played Brian Sims, and Liza Ross was the girl. The play was directed by Richard Wortley. Monk was produced by the BBC and presented by Earplay, the Radio Drama Production Center for Public Broadcasting.
Earplay is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.